Hello and welcome to History Happy Hour. I'm Josh Tomachek, and today we're going to be picking up with part two of what will, now I know for sure, will be a three-part series all about the Spanish flu. Now, if you've missed out on the first part, you can still hear it on khdx.fm. That is the website for this radio station. khdx.fm, and it should be posted there under the blog section. So I will try to publish each episode actually the day before you can hear them on the radio. So if you want a sneak peek, if you want to hear everything before everyone else does, just go to khdx.fm. And I just want to remind you, right now, you're listening to 93.1 KHDX in Conway, Arkansas. So today, I have a jam-packed episode planned, and I'm just going to go through it, try to get through as much as I can. And I'm recording outside, so you might hear some cars in the back. Hopefully, you only hear my voice, but we'll just see what happens. I'm still recording from home, and it's been quite the fun process. I've got quite the long planned for today, so I'm just going to try to get through as much as I possibly can. So last time we ended with the first wave of the virus, and now we're going to get into the second wave of the Spanish flu. This is the most destructive part of the plague. This was the one that caused the young, the 20 to 40-year-olds, to drown in their own fluids. Their lungs would fill up. Within 24 hours of showing symptoms, they could be dead. At its very worst, people would die within 12 hours of showing symptoms. Right? So young and healthy immune systems would actually turn against the body and trigger what's called a cytokine storm, or maybe cytokine storm. I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on this, but I'm just trying to share some background. And what this does is it causes the lungs to fill with cytokine fluid, and it would turn the face blue. And the stronger, the healthier, even the younger the immune system, if it was overcome by this disease, the response would be even stronger, and it would cause a quicker death. So in a way, having a healthier immune system was worse for you if you could not initially fight off this infection. In the second wave is when we hear about the scenes, the gruesome scenes of people living among the dead, of living among dead friends, relatives, and they're just too weak to bury or even move the dead, and oftentimes they had nowhere to move them. So if you'll remember, America is leaving, sending soldiers to fight in World War I. And during this time, during the second wave, you would hear stories about people sailors receiving quick prayers, and then their dead bodies were just dropped off of ships into the Atlantic because they had nowhere to store them. If you remember, a third to a half of American casualties in World War I were to the Spanish flu, and two-thirds of everyone who had died before reaching Europe, either in camps or on ships. And this virus infected at least 25% of the military. Still, that being said, they were some of the lucky ones. They had doctors and medical help provided to them as soldiers, with the backing of the most powerful governments in the world. And not everyone was so lucky. And we're going to get into some of that. To set the scene, it's August 1918, and the second wave begins. This is when it's really considered to become pandemic, to become worldwide. We're not entirely sure why it died off for a little bit during the summer of 1918, but it came back extremely deadly. And there are a few theories for this. As far as not really showing up as much in the summer of 1918, a lot of people think it just got used to humans and mutated to be better suited to survive in humans without killing. Because viruses actually do not want to kill their hosts. That's how they live. So they don't want to kill their hosts. It just happens that sometimes they kind of think that humans are something that they're not. And they end up killing their hosts kind of on accident. But we can see in fall, the virus did get much deadlier. And one theory about why it got so much deadlier was that mustard gas used in the Western Front actually promotes viral mutations. I don't know if that's true. I'm not an expert in this. Another theory is that they combined with other viruses. Once again, that blows my mind. I don't know how viruses combine with each other. I don't know how any of that works, but it's just a theory, and I thought it was interesting, so I decided to share. Either way, however this happened, it got much, much more contagious and way more deadly as well. So experts, what was the medical authority doing at this time? They really struggled to figure out what was going on. Some had predicted, but they didn't know it was influenza. You know, you have people like William H. Welch at the Rockefeller Institute working with the army. He thought that there was corresponding bacteria that might be causing it. Dr. Oswald Avery was not convinced by the bacteria, and he continued trying to find the cause of the infection. Dr. William Park and Dr. Anna Williams collaborated and rushed through the vaccine process and accidentally created vaccines that were not too effective at actually limiting the spread of this disease. So the medical community was really floundering. They had no idea what was going on, and they were really struggling to come up with a reasonable response, which is one of the main reasons why we have such rigorous testing of vaccines in the modern day. We really want to know that our vaccines will work. That's why you hear a lot about these phase 3 clinical trials for coronavirus vaccines, and that's because they need to make sure that these vaccines work before they're allowed to give it to the public. So the way that vaccines were created back then, I thought this was interesting. They would actually inject kind of serums into horses that contained the virus and then extract the antibodies that they made. Because horses obviously are their bodies are a lot stronger than ours. So if you get the antibodies from a horse, the horse will get, you know, a very, very minor illness, especially compared to humans. And you can take those antibodies and kind of work them in a way so that you can inject them as a vaccine into humans. But most of the efforts of the medical authority went into managing symptoms instead. And this was really when nurses became a very, very well-respected profession. The time that they spent with each individual patient was way more useful than the minimal time that doctors got to spend with each patient. So I'm gonna kind of, I do want to say that the kind of medical response to the Spanish flu was entirely centered in the West, the so-called developed world, but there was no medical response in many, many parts of the world. So that said, let's start in America and kind of trace the second wave from there to, quote, less developed parts of the world. So in August 1918, the second wave is in Boston. It's in the shipping lines. It's in France. Over the next 2 months, right, only 2 months, it would spread across North America, into Central America, then South America from ships, on ships from Europe, Africa, and America. Let's look at Brazil, for example. There's this big study that's mainly centered around Sao Paulo during that time. They saw massive agricultural output decreases, both in the long and short term. Rice was the biggest one. Its output was cut in half. And they found in this study that hospitalizations were up for 20 years. They were up from, you know, the expected amount. For 20 years after the first ship came from Europe that caught the Spanish flu in Senegal, West Africa. So there were lingering health impacts, especially on the lower class, especially on the ones that could not afford a very diverse diet and did not have medicine or any kind of care like that. And you can see just with how it came into Brazil, how connected the world was, and how, and this was the first time anything like that had happened. So a ship came from Europe, went to West Africa, and then to Brazil. It was flu-less in Europe, caught it in West Africa, and then came to Brazil. It was just nothing like that had ever happened before. It was a scale of shipping never seen before, and this was the first time that the negative impacts of having a connected world were really seen. So back on topic on Brazil, they found a number of impacts. They actually found an increase of literacy for men and lowered for women. Now, what does that mean? Where did that come from? So they came up with a number of explanations for this, and the most likely was that it killed the poorer Brazilians more than the wealthy, which the wealthy were more literate, so it would overall increase the literacy rates. And as for women, the lowered rate for women, people were investing more in boys than girls during and after the pandemic. Another thing that happened in Brazil, the fifth president of Brazil, Francisco de Paula Rodriguez, ran for presidency in 1918. He won the election with over 99% of the vote. That's ridiculous, but he won it with over 99% of the vote and was scheduled to take office on the 15th of November, 1918, but he was unable to do so because he died of, because he was too ill, and he died in January of 1919. To the Spanish flu. And so he caught it during the second wave, the deadliest wave. It would spread in those same 2 months after first emerging in August to Freetown, Sierra Leone, and across West Africa via ships, rivers, rails, cars, and all of the colonial infrastructure that, like I said earlier, was making the world smaller and smaller and smaller. And more interconnected than ever before. In September, it hit South Africa, primarily via the British South African Native Labor Corps that were coming home from France. So let's just talk about South Africa for a little bit. I'm kind of going to be jumping around from story to story from different places in the world. So in South Africa, there is a widespread and intense fear and panic of the incoming disease. You'll see that in places all around the world, especially, I'll see if we have time to get to America, but we might run out of time. That's why I'm talking so quickly. I've got a lot to get through. But in South Africa, the government blames the natives, the native Africans, because of course they did. This is South Africa. They cite their poor hygiene as the main reason why they blame that the natives are bringing this disease. And within 5 years, the governing white people would write a law preventing natives from entering urban areas without a special permit. It would further the apartheid regime that would last until the end of the 20th century. With Nelson Mandela, but that's a whole other story that we might get to later on an actually happy episode of History Happy Hour. So back to this grim episode of History Happy Hour, South Africa will lose 500,000 people to disease. 500,000 people will die to this disease, with many, many more permanently affected by this disease. Like I said, there were lasting medical impacts of catching this disease. And you have to remember that for every person that died, there is another family member or a friend who got sick and has to rebuild the broken society. And this is a common theme throughout that has never changed in the history of epidemics like this. There are people that got sick and just had to keep on going, who had lost people that they loved and just had to rebuild the society. And this is common throughout the history of disease, except in a few rare cases in which there was no one left. They all left or they all died. So South Africa was the hardest hit country in Africa. It lost very roughly, like I keep saying over and over, we can never know the exact number, but very roughly 3.5% of its population. Unsurprisingly, the wealthier white population were more likely to get medical help to treat their symptoms. And the general British government response was more concerned with treating the soldiers and supplying them with all the doctors and help that they had, because there was a war going on. Sometimes a war blocks out equal but less spectacular tragedies, less visible tragedies. So looping back to Europe, the Allies sent a number of soldiers to Russia following their surrender in 1917. If you'll remember, I mentioned last week, they broke out into a civil war that the Soviets ultimately won. That is a gross oversimplification, but it'll do for our purposes here. The Soviets ultimately won that civil war. Again, all of the political machinations and the warfare tended to overshadow the impact of this disease, so we don't know who died from the disease and who died from a Bolshevik bullet wound. We don't know. One thing I can say is this is one of the plethora of reasons why we have such a great variety of estimates of how many people and what percentages of people died due to the Spanish flu. So in Russia, this was called the Merman deployment, and these Allied soldiers brought the flu with them. And it especially hit the city of, I'm going to try to say this, Arkhangelsk. Arkhangelsk. That Russian city, Arkhangelsk. One of those. You know, it's that Russian city. From there, it spread via soldiers and on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. So the Russian soldiers were all fighting with each other, moving a ton of people in very cramped conditions all around to shoot each other. And when they weren't shooting each other, they were spreading disease to each other. And now we have the Trans-Siberian Railroad. This railroad spread the disease all the way across Asia. So it reached Mashhad, Iran, and then hit India by September, and then China and Japan by October 1918. So I'm going to take this moment to talk about India. So in India, there is a tradition that when someone dies, you build a funeral pyre and you burn their body, and then you spread the ashes into the Ganges River. They ran out of things to burn along the river, and there were bodies that were clogging the river in clumps. 20 million people, over 5% of the population of India at the time, would die as a result of the Spanish flu. This is the worst any people anywhere in the world would be hit by this disease. Why was it so bad in India? Well, there are many reasons, right? The colonial rule, the British rule at the time, didn't react to Indians dying the same way they did to English people dying. Much like in South Africa, the natives were kind of ignored. And because of years of deceit and mistreatment, Indians were generally distrustful of Western medicine anyways, and they may not have accepted help in these few cases that it was offered to them. And another thing, we don't know all the details of all the reasons why it was so bad, because it was not as well recorded as it was in Europe or in America. But unlike in South Africa, the Indian independence movement traveled into more rural areas, delivering traditional medicine, and gaining support as an alternative force to the colonial government. The independence movement also printed articles and would deliver them in the press, denouncing the British response and gaining the favor of the people. One lawyer and activist named, now known as Mahatma Gandhi, nearly died from this disease. He would later lead this independence movement, and India would declare independence from Britain. But I cannot emphasize enough how many people 5% of the population is. One out of every 20 people. How many people got sick and didn't die, but couldn't provide for their dying family because they were too weak? How many saw their friends die around them while not getting sick, wondering why they were spared, while so many were not? How many Gandhis did we lose to this disease who never had the chance to contribute to the world? It was terror unimaginable. About 20 million Indians died in 18 months. 50 to 100 million died worldwide in the same time span. Depending on the estimate, that is 20 to 40% of all Spanish flu deaths, all in one country. I physically cannot imagine one out of every 20 people dying. And how many more people got sick and didn't die? Once again, the records are just, they're not clear. They're just, it's one of the great frustrations of history that we just can't know everything. And the lack of records is also why there are such a huge variety of estimates for the Spanish flu. I'm sure many people would hear me say 50 to 100 million and think I'm way over exaggerating, and many people would say no, it was certainly 100 million, if not more. It was tremendously destructive, but one of the impacts was this growing support for the Indian independence movement, this unified front against an oppressive British rule. Okay. I'm checking the time here. I feel like I'm making pretty good progress. So, for my sake, mostly, I think it's time that we move outside of India and talk about just one of the success stories of the Spanish flu. Yes, they exist. There were success stories. Now, we have to kind of think about, well, what is success in a pandemic? It's just not as bad as it could have been. And that sucks, but it's a moment of optimism in such a terrible, terrible time in human history. So before I move on, I just want to remind you that you're listening to 93.1 KHDX from Conway, Arkansas. I'm Josh Tomacek. This is the History Happy Hour. We're talking about the Spanish flu. Now, last week I covered the first wave and the background, what's going on in the world before the Spanish flu emerged, and then the first wave of the Spanish flu. And you can go check that out at khdx.fm. I should be, hopefully, fingers crossed, publishing each episode the day before it comes out. But ultimately, it's up to the station of when exactly they publish it. I'll see what works, but that's my goal. So this is the History Happy Hour. Let's talk about a success story of the Spanish flu. Let's move on from India. Let's internalize that. I hope that my little commercial break, if you can call it that, in the middle of there kind of allowed you to really internalize what it means in the massive impact on India. So after all that, let me tell you a bit about Iceland. On the very same day that the pandemic reached Reykjavik, the Icelandic people had a referendum that ratified the Union Treaty with Denmark that declared Iceland a sovereign nation. The King of Denmark would still be the head of state, but Reykjavik now became the capital of a newly independent Icelandic nation. And there were planned celebrations for this historic event. Right? So people were going to be getting together, they were going to be close, they were going to be crowding. Basically, perfect environment for a disease to spread. Now, patient zero, we know patient zero is. So we have good records in Europe and we have good records in America. We know who patient zero was, or we know some things about her. Patient zero was a woman who was aboard a ship from Copenhagen in Denmark. She was visiting her brother who was attending university in Iceland. Two additional points of entry into Iceland were one British vessel and one American vessel. The epidemic in Iceland was mostly centered in Reykjavik, the largest city in Iceland, and the new capital. And as soon as they identified what was going on, there was a massive, massive response that split the Reykjavik population into, I believe it was 13 different precincts. And each person, every single person in the city, was accounted for by a special public health commission. Then the people just absolutely showed up in just a miraculous display of charity. The people of Reykjavik collected 63,000 krona, the currency there. 63,000, despite the average hourly wage being just 0.9 krona. .9 per hour, and these people were able to put it all together. That's 70,000 hours. The wages of 70,000 hours donated to help fight against this epidemic. I've lost my spot here. There it is. So volunteers made and delivered food outside the homes of families that could not feed themselves due to the overall and total complete shutdown of commerce and industry in the city. So people couldn't work. People were getting sick. They couldn't provide for their families. They couldn't buy food, they couldn't afford food, but it didn't matter because volunteers just made, they donated, they made food, they delivered food outside of the families, outside of the homes. You know, they just, you know, bring the food to the front door, leave it, and then the family could just open the door and feed themselves. All of the gatherings that were planned as soon as they recognized what was going on were either canceled or significantly reduced. And large parts of the country were completely quarantined from the rest, with guards stationed on roads, allowing only essential traffic. And if you're laughing at me for trying to pronounce that Russian city, I just wanted to try and quote this line from my research. Okay. Guards were posted on Hultefjord Heath, that's one word, and on Jolska River in Sulheimasandur in South Iceland to ensure that nobody who had been in contact with anyone infected could carry the infection into those areas. I just love Icelandic names. I love that language. I think it's wonderful. All right, little tangent. So they essentially were doing the same things that we're doing now. They're going, have you been in contact with anyone infected and you could be carrying the infection and not know it? You know, you could be what we call asymptomatic, right? You could be carrying the infection but not showing any symptoms and still carry the infection into new areas. And they would not allow anyone who had been in contact with anyone infected to go into different parts of the country. And they would quarantine off entire sections of the country so that it was extremely isolated in these very few hot spots of Spanish flu. So there were, I'll be the first one to admit this, a success story in a pandemic is only, it's not as bad as it could have been. So there were villages that were extremely hard hit by the disease, but there were also villages that saw no cases at all because they quarantined. Because they took this so seriously, because they had such a huge response, it was successful. And I don't think I can stress that enough, right? Turns out, if you take these diseases seriously, and people take it upon themselves to act with others in mind, and to act charitably, the negative impacts of pandemics are significantly lessened. The generosity of the Icelandic people during this time was wonderful. It was, you know, the ideal. It's what everyone wants to happen when a disease comes. And it is still remembered today. If you want to look for an example to work off of what to do during any epidemic, during any disease outbreak, look to Iceland in 1918. And next week, I'll share with you the absolute most extreme and by far most successful example of an effective response to an outbreak, but that'll have to wait until next week because I'm looking at the time and there's no way I'll be able to get through everything I want without a part three. So you better, if you're enjoying this, you better show up next week for part three, or once again, go to the website, khdx.fm, and go under the blog section. Look for History Happy Hour. Look for my name, Josh Tomacek. You should find it. So, I want to get back onto the narrative of the second deadly wave of the Spanish flu. So from Russia, traveled along the railroad. Once again, the world is interconnected. There's industrial means of transport that is spreading this disease like never before. It has reached China. And like I said last week, I'm pretty sure I said this last week, the virus is very, very poorly reported in China due to the regional warfare and the lack of government records. But by most accounts, primarily from European contacts along port cities, it was relatively unaffected by the Spanish flu. We do hear some stories of Christian missionaries going into more remote villages trying to spread Christianity. And they say that some of those villages were pretty hard hit. But once again, we don't know, right? There are very, very few records. But by most summaries, by most accounts, it was pretty unaffected compared to the rest of the world, especially compared to India. And I think we would know because China is very populous part of the world. It always has been, and it had similar density to India. And if there was a massive impact, we would have heard about it, whether the records were very good or very bad, just because it would have been such a big deal. So it was relatively unaffected. The same thing happened. The same thing can be said to a lesser extent in Japan. It was still pretty bad in Japan, but to a lesser degree than the worst parts of the world. But however, during this time, the cultural acceptance of mask wearing became mainstream in Japanese culture. Yes, they knew that masks helped. Even 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago now, 100 years ago, 102, they knew that masks helped. They knew that this would slow down and stop the spread of a virus. They knew it over 100 years ago, and it's honestly embarrassing to every time I hear someone say that they are not affected. We knew it 100 years ago. Anyways, I'm sorry. The cultural acceptance of mask wearing is still around in East Asia. People still wear it all the time, whenever they feel ill at all. Or they want to avoid breathing in highly polluted air in polluted areas. And I genuinely hope that this cultural acceptance spreads to other parts of the world, because masks are effective in dealing with almost all diseases, right, that are spread via, droplets from the mouth that are spread, through coughing, sneezing, etc. So, I hope that more people wear masks. It can only be a good thing. To loop it all the way back around the world to America, where we all live. I doubt I have any international listeners. There are a number of stories that I want to tell. I figure that statistics don't really make as good of radio as these stories, so hopefully I will have the time to get through them. Yeah, we're looking pretty good on time. I think I have another 10 minutes or so. Oh, we'll see. So, most famously, when you're learning about the Spanish flu in America, most famously on September 28th, 1918, in Philadelphia, the authorities, the mayor, mostly ignored the warnings from medical experts and decided to throw a massive Liberty Loan parade. Now, the purpose of this parade was to raise money for the war that would end in 2 months. Of course, no one could have possibly known it was only 2 months away. So raising funds was deemed more important than this disease. Right? They were thinking, scientists don't even know what's causing it, which is true. And we know the Germans are fighting against our doughboys, so we need to support them. We need to support our troops. So raising these funds for the war effort is more important than some disease that we don't even know anything about. And after all, they were getting out of summer, right? They thought that the epidemic had come and ended. They thought it had flared, and then it had smoldered, and now it was gone. And there were a few cases showing up here and there, but it will most likely be fine, right? And I don't know if I can really fault them for that. Obviously, knowing in hindsight, they obviously shouldn't have done it, and they should have listened to the medical experts. But the trend was sloping downwards, and it was basically vanishing, and it was just basically just a bad flu, you know. It wasn't too bad. The elderly and infants were at risk, but, you know, they still needed to raise these funds for war. They knew that raising funds for the war would have a positive impact, and they didn't know that having this would be so bad. But they were wrong. In fact, they were dead wrong. 12,000 Philadelphian deaths were directly linked to this parade. 12,000. So maybe, crazy idea. I'm getting a little snarky here. Crazy idea. They should have probably listened to the medical experts. Okay, let's stay in America. In the cramped conditions, and drawing recruits from all over the country, military camps were where the disease was the very worst. The army had to arrange special trains that were their only purpose was to carry away the dead from camps. This is where we see the worst of the worst of the Spanish flu. We see buildings where there is no more floor space for the sick. They are just lying on the floor on top of each other. There's no more room. We see people dying suddenly within 12 hours of showing symptoms. Doctors are getting sick and can no longer work on patients. It's terrible, right? It's basically the ideal conditions to kill as many people as possible and to spread the disease to as many people as possible. William H. Welch, the head of the American Medical Association, was sent by the Army to Fort Devens, Massachusetts. Now, I had mentioned him last week, and he recommends that the Army shut down all troop movements and quarantine people. And he recommends this to his boss, Surgeon General William Gorgas, who I also mentioned last week. And he brings the case to the higher-ups, the generals in military command. The military refused his request to completely shut down all troop movements. They have a war to fight. I'm not sure if you know William Gorgas, but we're in a war right now. So they refuse. You know, citing the weakness of the German army. They didn't know that the war was going to end in 2 months, but they got a feeling that they heard rumors that the Ottomans and the Austrians were working on peace talks, and that the Germans were just one push away from finally surrendering. And they were kind of right, you know. I think these generals knew what they had to do to win a war, and they just determined that shutting down all troop deployments was just not worth it. You know, a third to a half of all casualties during World War I were to the Spanish flu, and they determined that it was not a big enough concern to them that they were going to risk military success. Once again, I don't know how much judgment I can pass. I think it's ultimately up to you what you think, whether they were justified in doing what they did. But they did agree, when Gorgas pleaded with them, they did agree to stop the next round of drafts, because the training camps that were training new soldiers to go fight in war had completely shut down because of the huge influenza outbreak. One particular story stands out. At Camp Grant, I did not write this down. I believe it's Illinois. Let me actually look that up. Yes, Camp Grant, Illinois. A commander refuses to heed the medical advice of a doctor to reduce overcrowding on trains and in the barracks, much like so many other commanders also did across the nation in military camps. The doctor said, "This is against regulation. You can't do this. It's putting them at unnecessary risk. And we need to slow down what we're doing and stop this before it becomes a big issue." The commander, his rationale was, we're in a war. We need as many soldiers as we can. We need as many bodies headed to the Western Front on the front lines as we can possibly get. 2 weeks later, that same doctor would walk into the same office to inform that same commander that the camp had run out of coffins. That soldiers were dying by the thousands. That commander ordered the doctor out of the room, pulled his pistol out of his desk, and took his own life. So that's the military response. I'm quickly running out of time here, but let me just talk about two cities. Let me talk about Philadelphia, and let me talk about New York. Now, hospitals in New York and Philadelphia were filling up as the disease spread from the military population to the civilian population. And the civilian side got little warning about the scope of the disease from the government in an attempt to preserve wartime morale. Philadelphia was the hardest hit city in America. Like I said, they had this big parade. 12,000 deaths were linked directly to that parade, and there were many more deaths throughout the next few months. Private practice doctors ended up making 60 plus house calls a day. Morgues filled up and could no longer accept any more bodies from the hospitals. In the hospitals, people who had turned blue were just tagged for the morgue. They were just seen as lost hopes, lost cases, and they were just accepted that they were going to die soon. Eventually, the church responded, and priests volunteered to help with the backlog of bodies. They raised money and helped dig new graves, and they would stack coffins too deep and then recite prayers at night over the bodies, keeping track of exactly who was buried where. This is when we get reports of people in America living with the dead in their homes, too weak to move them, and nowhere to send them, right? The hospitals were full, the morgues were full. Eventually, a warehouse and cold storage were rented to store the bodies before they were buried. And there were thousands of bodies to keep track of. There was a massive backlog. Volunteers eventually took over after a lack of a government response. And by the end of October, the government failed to function and basically private volunteers took over the entire response, driving makeshift ambulances and working in primitive 911s. In New York City, however, they had some experience in fighting epidemics. And full quarantine was not possible due to the war going on, but they had experience from, you know, the massive immigration on Ellis Island and stuff. They would check for diseases before they got into New York. And the public health service had a major presence in the city. So there were laws that criminalized spitters in the city, you know, people who would just spit on the streets. There were laws that criminalized people who didn't cover their mouths while coughing and sneezing. And there were notices sent out to everyone encouraging people to self-quarantine in their homes if sick, report that illness to the doctors, and they called for all people to wear masks. Yes, they called for people to wear masks because masks are over 100 years old and they work. And they also set up what we now call contact tracing to try to see if they could stop people from spreading the disease further. And the final thing they did was they encouraged workplaces to stagger their times and to minimize contacts between different shifts of workers. However, in both of these places, there was extreme fear driven by lack of information from the press to preserve wartime morale. Panicked people don't go to the shipyards. They don't go to factories to work. I'm quickly running out of time, so let me just say a few more things. Some towns in America quarantined themselves entirely, shutting themselves off from the rest of the country. Even some of them hired armed guards to stop people from entering or exiting the town. One person remained remarkably silent about the whole issue, and that was President Woodrow Wilson. He did basically nothing about the flu other than to affirm that the United States would continue sending soldiers across the Atlantic to fight in the Great War. As winter approached, the cases dipped, reaching a peak between October and November. And it's kind of strange. As quickly as the disease came, it also went. And the world had just kind of run out of fuel for the second and the most deadly wave of the pandemic. Some predict a similar shape of infection from COVID. Right now, they think we're in the second wave. If you remember, we had that first wave, and then places started to reopen, and then we're in the second wave, and now places are closing again. And some people think that there's going to be a third. But for the sake of thousands of lives, I certainly hope that we can keep quarantine and really make sure that we're as safe as we can be from this disease. On that optimistic note, this has been History Happy Hour. Join me next week for part 3. We'll talk about some stories that I wasn't able to get to, and we'll talk about some of the impacts of the disease, and we'll talk about the third wave. Much, much milder than the second. And we'll talk about some places that I haven't been able to cover. All right. I've been Josh Tomacek. This has been the History Happy Hour. You're listening to 93.1 KHDX in Conway, Arkansas. Join me next week.